Hello, this is Peter Fisher, and this is week 3 of the Fisher Files. And this week I'm going to talk about projects. When I wake up in the morning, can't explain the way it feels. Then we're moving in a new direction. So this week's topic is projects. Last week, we talked about buckets in the weekly review. And in the next few weeks, we'll put together a few different ideas. This week are our projects. Next week will be to-do lists. And the week after that will be your calendar. And this is more descriptive rather than instructions. But it is meant to help you and help you think about it and help me think about it as well. So the first question is really, what's a project? Well, you can look it up in the dictionary, and it's usually got some endurance and breadth to it. It's not just a single activity, but it's a composition of several sequential activities to achieve a goal. So projects I think of as kind of the glue between really large aims in your life and the daily activities. A project gives a context to make that connection. For example, a big goal in your life might be to learn how to play the piano. So if you don't know how to play the piano, an example of a project aimed at that goal would be to purchase a piano. Now, a project, typically, that's a kind of a good example, typically is something that's going to take some amount of time, days or weeks or months. I find it not terribly useful to have projects that are too open-ended and span more than a year. But days or weeks or months is about right. And it's going to have a whole bunch of little steps to it. So if your project is to buy a piano, the steps are going to be something like find out how big a piano you can accommodate in your house, what kind of piano you can afford, what style of piano you'd like. Do you want a concert grand or a grand piano or an upright or an electronic keyboard? There's probably some research involved, going to Amazon or Googling piano on the web, talking to people, accumulating information. And then there's going to be a step of reviewing all of the information and trying to decide what makes sense for you. And then the final step is the actual purchase of the piano. And probably that's not the final step. There's the having it delivered and getting it where you want it and maybe having it tuned. So a project will have all of these steps. And the best way I think of something that makes a good project, Meg Edwards, who works for David Allen's company, told me this, is that you've got to have a good, clear, crisp statement of what does done look like. So you can say this project is done when, dot, dot, dot. So in the piano buying case, the project is done when there's a piano sitting somewhere in your house that you can play. Now, as academics, our life really is all about projects. And in particular, at every level, whether you're an undergraduate or a senior faculty member, what you really do a lot of are initiate projects. So in contrast, for example, if you were working at a bank and thinking about how to organize your time and where to empty your buckets, a project might be something that's handed to you. You have a client that comes in that needs a loan. You have a senior bank official that wants you to carry out an audit. You're given a project, and then it's up to you how to organize it. Academics, you know, we're supposed to quiet our mind and have misty-eyed thoughts and come up with some new idea, some expansion of knowledge. And the project is taking that misty idea and solidifying it, seeing how it fits with other ideas, other existing models, testing it, maybe developing an experiment or a piece of computer code, or you know, eventually kind of the end of the project is a publication or a talk. So projects are really what we do, and we probably all have some pretty innate feeling for how to organize the academic projects we have. Keep in mind, any system of organizing your time and resources works a lot better if it's comprehensive, meaning covering all aspects of your life. So projects can also be home repairs, home finances, family endeavors, traveling a vacation, planning a vacation, planning Christmas shopping, planning your kids' education. All of those things are going to be projects. And the most useful way I see, or I have, of organizing projects is I use a thing called Palm Desktop. And Palm Desktop has a memo feature. A memo is just a, you know, you click a little box and up pops a memo, and you can type in a title. And then there's just a blank space where you can type stuff. And you can also put it in a category. So I just have a category of memos called projects. So I can click the, you know, show memo button, and I just have a list of all of the projects that I have. And so all the projects I have defined right now, there is a total of 41 of them. And in every one of those projects, you can click it and get a list of notes. So during the weekly review, one way it works is I just look at my list of projects and I go through them one by one, click them open, and see where they are. And if there is something to be done on the project, I put that on the to-do list. If on my to-do list, you know, I've emptied a bucket there somewhere that says, think about this for that project, I put that in the right project and then click it closed. Now, in the course of my weekly review, I may look at a project and decide, I'm not going to do that, or I'm going to do that some other time. So if I'm not going to do it, I just delete it. And I'll tell you, one of the most satisfying things about this whole business, the whole, you know, buckets and projects and to-do lists, is deciding you're not going to do something. It's really empowering. You know, sometimes it's something that's really important to somebody, but, you know, I just look at my list and there are all these things that are just more important, and sorry, not going to do it. Some projects you're interested in, and you know, maybe you're going to do them some other time, and you don't want to forget about them, but you don't want them on your active list because you're just not going to do anything with them for the foreseeable future. Those, I have another memo category called Someday Maybe. This phrase comes from David Allen, and I just change the category of that project to from, you know, a project to someday maybe. And so I probably have 70 or 80, you know, really good ideas for projects sitting in the someday maybe pile. And one thing I do in my weekly review is I go through the someday maybe pile or category and just glance at all those. Takes about 2 minutes. And if it looks like I have time or interest, I change the project back to, you know, an actual project. I also have a category called projects/completed, so that when I finish a project, when I've gotten to what done looks like, I just change the project category to that. and then it disappears off of my active list, but I still have, you know, some information about the project itself. So the idea of projects is that when you're walking around and you have a really good idea for something that you're working on, it somehow goes into a bucket, you know, the little notebook you carry, or onto your to-do list, or a voice memo, or whatever. And then when you review all of those things, all what's in all of your buckets, it comes out of that bucket and goes into that project. Now, you don't need to have Palm Desktop or a Palm Pilot to do any of this. There are systems for doing this with folders. You can do this with notebooks. You can do it with a binder with little sleeves, and you move things back and forth between the sleeves. It really doesn't matter how you do it. The key idea is to have the concept of a project as something you're going to work on over a sustained period that has a really well-defined completion. And that's an important thing. A project like, you know, learn how to play the piano is not really a very good project because it doesn't have a really well-defined finish. It's also just too broad. So if you had the aim in your life to learn how to play the piano, that would actually be several projects. You know, project one, which we've always already talked about, is find a piano. Project two is find a piano teacher. Project three might be learn how to play chopsticks, and so on. So you want to kind of take the big goals of your life and look at them and think about them and break them down into projects that have reasonable durations and really clear ends. Another thing that's very, very satisfying is changing a project from, you know, a regular project to a completed project. It's done, and you can sort of forget about it and move on. Now, a project usually has a lot of materials associated with it, or might have a lot of materials associated with it. And so the way I do things is I just have a drawer with all my project files alphabetically in it. And each project is a folder, or, you know, several folders. On the computer, there's my, you know, documents directory, and in the documents directory is a subdirectory for each project, so any files go into those. Sometimes I have a mail folder that's associated with a project, although mail is changing a lot. We'll talk about that later. And also, since a lot of things I do involve programming and coding, in my CVS repository, I have projects, a projects directory, and then subdirectories for each project sitting under there. So if you use this just as a basic structure, you can mirror it in, on your computer, in your filing system, on your Palm Pilot if you have one, or in a system of folders. It's quite a nice way of thinking about things. Now, there are some schools of thought that think, okay, you know, you're going to have all these documents and things, and you've got to keep track of them. So one thing I've seen suggested in a book called How to Organize Your Work and Your Life, which is kind of an awful little book, but that, you know, every project gets a number that's a multiple of 1,000. So project number one has number 1,000, project number two has number 2,000, etc. And then every document gets a number in the units. So the first document is 1,001, the second document is 1,002, etc. And then on the outside of your folder, you write what each document is. So you have 1,001 notes on this project. Document 1002, paper I found relevant to this project. I did this for a while when I was first assistant professor, and you know, I found that, you know, there was so much time associated with, you know, writing the number and writing the title and what it was, and even for a while I was punching it all into a database, that I just kind of stopped. And the lesson here isn't really so much about projects or documents or about something, is that if whatever means you're using to organize yourself and keep track of stuff is becoming cumbersome and you're having to think about it, then it's really not very good. You know, if you can keep track of where everything is just in your mind without having this crazy dialogue going on, fine. You know, if your mind is already quiet, then you don't need any of this. So what you really want to do is keep the bureaucracy to a minimum. And, you know, if you can survive with all your projects and, you know, one big stack of papers sitting on the corner of your desk, that's great. So, you know, you don't need to have some fancy system for keeping track of things. The other thing I did for a while that was really kind of stupid was to make everything a project. So, you know, getting my haircut's a project. Preparing the lecture for my class is a project. That's really, again, too much bureaucracy. You know, you've got to trust yourself and think that, you know, you're going to have things that are projects, and you're just going to have little things that you need to do every day. I don't put, you know, prepare a lecture on lecture 17 on my to-do list because I know I need to prepare lecture 17. It's not bothering me that I have to prepare lecture 17. It's part of my routine. Just like, you know, I get up, I make my daughter's breakfast, I make her lunch for school, I take a shower, I brush my teeth. I don't need those things on a to-do list. It's just kind of habit. So don't go overboard with to-do lists or creating projects. You'll know a project when you see it. You know, something that has a few steps that you really need to keep track of and some materials associated with it. I'd be interested to hear how others look at projects. David Allen has a sort of multi-tiered approach to this, which I tried, didn't find worked really well. There's all kinds of project planning software. There's Omni Outliner, which runs on Macs. There's a thing called Mind Mapper, which is used for brainstorming projects. There's Omni Griffle, which is a flowcharting program. And some of these you can define a project and then define tasks underneath and set things up so each task automatically goes on to a to-do list at the right time. I've never really felt like I needed one of those, although I've messed around with them. They are pretty cool. There's a free product called Kinkless GTD. GTD stands for Getting Things Done, which is part of the large David Allen cult of organization. That works with Omni Outliner. So if you really got a yen to do something techie, Omni Outliner with Kinkless GTD is a good thing to start with. Of course, then the PDAs, Palm Pilots and Trios and things like that have all kinds of project trackers and things. I've always found that just the little memo feature is just fine. You know, you just have a title and write what you're doing there. I always start by writing down done looks like blah 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 blah. Because that really kind of keeps the edges sharp so that the project is really tightly defined. So to kind of summarize, I look at projects as the link between your big life aims and the things that you're going to do every day. the 200 little tasks you perform every day. And you've got to develop the skill to scope out a project so that it's kind of the right size and right duration that makes sense, and then come up with a way of keeping track of what your projects are and what state they're in. And for this, the weekly review is really critical. One of the things you do each week is you go and you look at every project and you see what that is. If the project's no longer relevant, get rid of it. If it's done, mark it done and get rid of it. If you've got buckets that empty it into the project, empty them in, get it out of your mind. And if there are things to do for each project, put them on your to-do list, which we'll talk about next week. And remember, everything isn't a project. Getting your hair cut, brushing your teeth, are just things you do. So there were a lot of things that popped up that I thought was really interesting in the journals this week, for this week's Mind Feed. Probably the thing I found most intriguing was an article in Nature with the title, "The Earth's Hum is Driven by Ocean Waves Over the Continental Shelves." You probably don't know about this, but if you just look at the seismic spectrum of the planet Earth, there are, of course, earthquakes, and they come and go. But there's a sort of constant power spectrum over the range of millihertz to hertz, and it's not inconsequential. The units they use are meters per second per hertz, so that's a measure of longitudinal lateral velocity in frequency units, and in decibels compared to 1 meter per second per hertz, or I'm sorry, meter, it's more complicated than that, it's acceleration per hertz. In terms of decibels, it's down by about 180 dB from that. So it's they're pretty small, but they're there, and the range between a millihertz and 10 millihertz is called the hum. And so the Earth is just kind of ringing or humming constantly at this frequency. And it's been a mystery for quite some time. People have claimed that it's some kind of turbulent coupling between the atmosphere and the continents. But what this fellow, Sapir C. Webb, has done is carry out a calculation which shows that it's really consistent with wind-driven ocean waves washing up on the continental shelf. Now, the wind-driven ocean waves also contribute to sort of the 100 millihertz frequency range, and those are the deep ocean waves that interfere with each other and then couple actually very, very weakly to the Earth through the ocean floors. What he's shown is that these even lower frequencies are the coupling of the waves via the continental shelf. So that's a little mystery that's been around for a long time that looks like it could be resolved. There is another very interesting article about advanced accelerator technology. This is called Wakefield Plasma Acceleration. I think this is also in Nature, but it's been published in Physical Review Letters, and you can get it off the Slack website. In order to get to very high energies, the way that we do it now most reliably is just with radio frequency cavities, and this is for accelerating particles. The electrons or positrons just kind of surf along the electromagnetic wave. And the maximum gradients you can get, which is the how much energy you can put into the particle, is sort of 30 MeV per meter. So if you want to build a machine that's a GeV, it's kind of 30 meters of RF cavities, we want to build a machine that's sort of 500 GeV, so that's 15,000 meters or 15 kilometers, and that's for each type of particle. So if it's a collider, it's kind of 30 kilometers, two colliders pointing at each other. These fellows at SLAC have shown that if you have a meter of plasma and you fire a bunch of electrons into it, what happens is that the lead electrons push the electrons away from their course in the plasma, and then the electrons move back with the plasma oscillation frequency, and this sets up a very high acceleration gradient that pushes the particles behind the front of the bunch that you fire in. It actually accelerates them, not very efficiently, only a few percent gain any energy, but there are electrons that double the energy. So the SLAC LINAC is 3 kilometers long and makes a 42 GeV beam, and they stick 1 meter of plasma at the end and get out a few electrons, a small fraction, that are actually at 84 GeV. So, of course, this has got everybody very excited, and the idea that you can just, you know, sort of stick a meter of something on the end is very intriguing, but it's a long way to go before that works. But it's big news. There was also widely reported the outcome of an internal investigation at Purdue about this fellow, trying to find his name here, Talakanian, I think, who the name is Tal Yarkon at Purdue, who uses, I think, essentially sonically produced bubbles in deuterated liquid to produce fusion. Of course, it's called bubble fusion. Of course, nobody else has been able to reproduce this, and people have complained to Princeton, and there was an internal investigation about fraud, and he's since been vindicated. I mean, none of this is really very important. This is not, from what I can see, the next great energy source. The reason I mention this is the article is kind of interesting because it's, again, sort of like the James Shirley case, a case where the university, because of its self-imposed confidentiality and, confidentiality rules, can't really respond to a lot of charges that are made about its behavior. And I'm certainly not defending it, but it's just kind of another illustration of how universities are very funny places. Another thing that's been widely reported, I mentioned 2 weeks ago the release of the reference design review for the linear accelerator, which came out to be about $7 billion plus 13,000 man-years of work. There are articles various places, and Bert Richter is widely quoted. He's a Nobel laureate, shared the Nobel Prize with Sam Ting for the discovery of the J-psi particle. He's quoted to say that he doubts very much that this will go ahead very quickly. If the LHC turns out nothing, I doubt very much that the governments are going to put up the money. Basically, he's kind of going out of his way to say that this is very unlikely to happen. I don't know whether that's true or not. What I do want to remark, and since part of this podcast is about, you know, help helping all of us be better scientists is it's very, very seldom helpful to make negative generalizations about projects, no matter how much you despise them, particularly in the realm of politics. Gratuitous criticism never helps anybody. That's just been my experience. It gets your name in print because people are always looking for people to say shit. And, you know, old Bert's there looking like Jabba the Hutt saying shit. And, you know, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong, but it doesn't, at least to me, as someone who's more than mildly interested, it doesn't really add much to the discussion. The final thing I wanted to mention, again, this is pretty widely reported, is the Svalbard International Seed Vault, which is a big underground vault that will contain 1 or 2 million crop strains. It's in Norway somewhere, built into a mountain, 120 meters down into the mountain. And so everybody's putting all this food strains in, and the idea is that you know, after whatever Holocaust befalls us, we'll be able to go in there and get out whatever we need to make corn. Apparently, there are a lot of crop strain repositories around the world, just to make sure. A little bit creepy, I'd say. Well, maybe I forgot all about love, or maybe I forgot about the heavens up above, or maybe, baby, you just don't do nothing for me. You ain't stirring. So that's it for this week. The mind feed was recorded with a new microphone, so hopefully you won't be hearing my iPod disc spin up and down. Hopefully the quality is a little bit better. Next week, we're going to talk about you and your to-do list, or lists. You'll find out you're going to have a lot of to-do lists. And say a little bit about the calendar, and more about the calendar the week after. The to-do and calendar are pretty much pretty intimately connected. So I'm putting links to various things I mentioned today on the program notes, and I'd like to thank Sheila Holzer Marston and husband John for continuing support, Sean Thompson and Newman Galinas for help with the computing, and Bonnie Newman and Homer Reed for encouragement via refs. We're listed on iTunes now, so if you want to use iTunes to download this to your iPod, you can just go look for the Fisher Files on iTunes. If you Google the Fisher Files, there's a guy named Jeffy Fisher who has been doing weekly podcasts for quite a long time and has a website called the Fisher Files. I've only listened to one. It's kind of a weird thing about something. He sounds interesting and pretty good, so maybe they'll be complimentary to this. Anyway, I'll talk to you next week, and in the meantime, have a good time in Cambridge or wherever you are. I'm not the woman that you want me to be. I ain't sorry. I'm not feeling blue. I ain't sorry that I'm over you. I ain't sorry. I ain't sorry. I ain't sorry. No, I ain't sorry that I said goodbye. I ain't sorry that I made you cry. I ain't sorry that I'm not the woman that you want me to be. And I ain't sorry. I'm not feeling blue. I ain't sorry that I'm over you. I ain't sorry. I ain't sorry. I ain't sorry. Sorry that I said goodbye. I ain't sorry that I made you cry. I ain't sorry that I'm not the woman that you want me to be. I ain't sorry. I'm not feeling blue. I ain't sorry.